Good morning. Our first case this morning is Loving against the United States. Counsel for the petitioner, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, this is a capital case here in habeas corpus proceedings following remand from a Dubay evidentiary hearing. Dwight Loving was first sentenced to death in 1989, a little more than 3 months after his trial, and this was, in fact, the first case affirmed by this court, first military capital case affirmed by this court on direct appeal. The essence of the argument that we are here on today is whether Dwight Loving's trial defense counsel conducted an adequate, reasonable, thorough, independent investigation for mitigation evidence to present in sentencing. At bottom, his trial defense counsel knew that this was going to be a life or death decision. There were confessions in the case, so they were all clear that they were going to the final sentencing decision. They also knew going into that, as any attorney does in a capital case, that once they completed the guilt or innocence finding and there was a conviction, that the jury would be tasked with making a reasoned moral judgment against the man they did not know and that they had just convicted of two murders, an attempted murder, and five armed robberies over a two-day period. The essential facts of what the trial attorney actually did do and the military judge found, and by and large, we do not dispute the military judge's findings with respect to what the trial defense counsel did and what they considered. But basically, their testimony and the findings were that after initial interviews with Dwight Loving, they formulated a strategy, and that strategy was that he was susceptible to and being influenced by his girlfriend, Nadia Pacino. After that, they never strayed from that strategy, but they also never conducted a thorough and independent investigation of his background. In the 3 months that they had leading up to the sentencing, the lawyers, neither of whom, well, there were three of them, but really there was lead counsel Bill Ibbotson, individual military counsel Major Dave Hayden, and then they assigned a third lawyer who really was not involved in the process so much, other than discussing it with them. But none of them had any capital defense experience, and none of them had any more than approximately 5 years as a lawyer. With that, they did not request a mitigation specialist. They did not request an investigator. The in-person interviewing concerning Dwight Loving's background prior to his entry in the military was that Major Hayden, who was a white officer representing the black accused, went to the inner city of Rochester, New York, in full military uniform to interview Dwight Loving's mother and several brothers. His notes reflect that he spent no more than 3 hours with them.
Now later they came, Dr. Armitage joins the team, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
I understand your argument that he comes in after the fact, at a later moment after the trip to Rochester and so on. Putting aside the timeline, which we'll get to in a second, is it your argument that he was not professionally equipped to guide counsel in how to conduct an investigation?
Well, my first position, Your Honor, is that he was not involved in guiding them.
No, that's a timeline. I want to just ask you about his professional competence, though. Let's say Dr. Armitage had joined in at the very beginning, the day counsel was assigned. Was he professionally competent and equipped? Whether he did so is a different matter, but was he professionally competent and equipped to provide guidance on how to investigate and how to relate social history to conduct?
He was certainly qualified as a forensic psychiatrist. Whether he was qualified to conduct or to advise, well, let's start with whether he was qualified to conduct an investigation. I think certainly he could interview the witnesses. He would have the mental health experience. I've never heard of a forensic psychiatrist that goes out in the field and requests records and knows where to get those records. And
I understand the distinction. He might know how to ask, tell you what to ask for, but not necessarily where to find it.
And then moving to the next step of whether he was competent to tell the defense counsel how to do it. Again, you're left with defense counsel that, number one, does not have mental health experience, but beyond that, even assuming that defense counsel can conduct adequate interviews, you've got another problem in this case that they didn't.
Was Armitage equipped, whether he did or did not, was Armitage equipped to say he comes in X days before the trial and he sees what they have? Was he not equipped to say, gee, why didn't you interview the boxing coach? Or gee, why didn't you do this?
Well, they did interview the boxing coach.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to fill in the blank.
The essence of that problem
was he not competent to say we're missing something here?
If there's an obvious hole in what they are presented, but the forensic mental health expert is generally not involved in saying, okay, did you do this? Did you do that? What Dr. Armitage did in this case, virtually 5 days before panel selection started, he showed up. The only people he interviewed were the people that the trial defense counsel had already determined were going to be witnesses, or they had been subpoenaed and the travel arrangements had been made. And it's very similar to what the U.S. Supreme Court had in Rompia versus Beard. There, the defense counsel conducted their own investigation. They had several mental health experts involved doing evaluations and reviewing the information that the attorneys provided, but a mental health expert cannot look at the picture presented to them and tell what's missing from it. So it doesn't fix it. It doesn't put an MD stamp on an otherwise adequate investigation if the expert doesn't say, you're missing something. That's not what a forensic psychiatrist does. That's what counsel does. That's what the mitigation specialist does in conducting the investigation. And going back here, what they did, going to the inner city, talking to Dwight Loving's mother, who came from the rural segregated South, and part of her family had in fact moved to Rochester because of racial reasons during the civil rights movement. They were there approximately a week after the police and CID agents had been to interview them. And Major Hayden's notes reflected that he was recording the conversation.
Counsel, the military judge found that the use of a mitigation specialist in 1989 was an emerging practice, that it was not a standard or not a requirement. Is that a finding of fact or a conclusion of law? What standard do we apply when we look at that?
I think it is a mixed question, which puts it basically under de novo review. I mean, in addition to the testimony of Major Hayden, which Major Hayden's testimony is the only place that you find that it's an emerging practice. He said he went to a CLE called Life in Balance Capital Defense Seminar, and he heard about it, but it was an emerging practice. But everything else, before the Dubay judge and before this court, is that
the ABA standards, in effect at the time, did not say it was a requirement, and yet in the 2002 ABA guidelines did say that it was. Obviously, it was something other than that earlier.
Well, I think the evidence is this, Your Honor. The ABA guidelines did refer to trained investigators and trained experts to help in the investigation. So the label mitigation specialist did not appear. But as Rompia pointed out, the 2003 guidelines only expand on the standard of care, which really is what the 1989 guidelines were. Wiggins refers to them as the well-defined norms. There was expert testimony in the Dubay from Sean O'Brien, who in 1989 was a public defender in Kansas City, Missouri, substantial capital case experience, that he was doing it in every single case. Sometimes it was a social worker, sometimes it was another person that was specifically experienced in doing this investigation and evaluation. The trial attorneys themselves consulted with Robert McGlasson, who is an attorney at the Texas Death Penalty Resource Center, and in fact was the person that put together the manual and the materials and the program for the seminar that Major Hayden attended. He testified that it was standard in his practice. He advised these trial attorneys when they came to him that they were just on the tip of the iceberg, that attorneys are not the appropriate people to be doing these evaluations. There were publications put into evidence and in a debate hearing from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers magazine called The Champion, which is, you know, still today sort of the Bible, or not the Bible, that's misspeaking, but a valued source for defense counsel in all criminal cases.
Can you go through the guidelines from 89 and point to the specific language that in your view you believe indicates that a mitigation specialist was required?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I cannot, but I refer to it in the brief where there's discussion about trained investigators and expert witnesses. If you'll allow, I will find the specifics.
And do it on rebuttal? Yeah, that'd be very helpful. Now, I take it you argue in the alternative as well, that it's not solely just the 89 guidelines, but that in any event, whatever investigation occurred had to be reasonable, whether the guidelines set that standard or not. It would be useful in rebuttal that if you could please point directly to the text from the guidelines that you think is controlling here, and indicate perhaps which of your supplementary authorities, because your briefs allude to them but don't actually say emphatically what they are. What additional authority from that time period indicated that a mitigation specialist was not only a good idea, but essential?
In 1990, this court authorized funding for mitigation specialists.
But that's different than saying, that's not saying it's required or essential, that's saying it's authorized. Okay?
Well, Your Honor, I can make the argument, I do make the argument, I've covered it substantially in the briefs, that a mitigation specialist was standard. It was the standard of practice, but in this case, that's not the ultimate issue. And even if the court disagrees with me on that, the ultimate point is that whether the mitigation specialist does it or counsel does it, a reasonable, thorough investigation to look for, you know, all available mitigation evidence was not conducted in this case. Aside from the 3 hours of in-person recorded interviews, it was a different defense counsel for Dwight Loving that followed up with family members in limited phone calls. So other than those 3 hours of recording, there were no in-person interviews of any of the family members until they arrived on the eve of trial.
And what requires that?
I'm sorry?
And what requires in-person interviews?
Common sense. I mean, if you're looking for all of the diverse human frailties that Woodson versus North Carolina talks about, meaning what this court, as well as every other court dealing with capital cases in the country, has seen, and what is in Dwight Loving's background, physical abuse,
Please explain to me what we're talking about today that isn't basically an attempt to relitigate what was litigated 14 years ago on direct appeal.
I think we are relitigating what was done on direct appeal.
Thank you.
This court previously found, based on the affidavits and information presented, that Dwight Loving was entitled 14 years ago, essentially, to an evidentiary hearing. So nothing about the facts of Dwight Loving's case has changed. So we are here on the same issue. There's no question about that.
Thank you.
Counsel, to recap where you just were on this issue of the mitigation specialist, at the point we're in the litigation right now, then, is there any significance to the question of whether there was or was not a mitigation specialist? Or at this stage, is the question, was there a reasonable investigation regardless of who did or did not perform it?
The latter part is the ultimate question in this case. This court is not asked to decide, in this case, is a mitigation specialist required? That's one element of defense counsel, and Ibbotson testified that he knew or he thought that there were probably race and culture issues. They weren't satisfied that the family was being upfront with them. He knew that they were suspicious of, quote, his white lawyers. But, you know, the only effort made was 3 hours in person and phone calls. People are not going to tell you about the sex abuse, the violence in their homes, everything going on in the community in those circumstances. And they weren't even looking for it. Major Hayden testified that they were looking for specific information of antisocial behavior, whether he boxed without headgear and other erratic behavior, how he behaved in pressure situations. Basically, that initial strategy from only initial interviews from Dwight Loving, from that point on, they had talented. They didn't say that in their testimony using those words, but that's what they said.
Didn't they say in the debate that they were kept a fluid attitude toward their strategy?
Major Hayden testified that he would have investigated other matters if something new had been raised by the family or the people he interviewed in Rochester. But that basically turns counsel's burden on its head. It puts the burden on people that are living in the inner city of Rochester, New York, with no legal experience, no knowledge whatsoever, to figure out what's mitigating. What's important to tell this lawyer who is not even asking me about these subjects? And that's just a burden that, you know, one, family member can't carry, and two, it's not theirs from the start.
What red flags, if any, did the counsel, I'm not sure what the right metaphor is, drive by that should have clued them to the need to further investigate or further interview? You have the comment about the white lawyer thing, which is one of the red flags you've highlighted. What other red flags should have alerted counsel that further inquiry was needed?
Well, similar to Wiggins, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, you have to look at the quantum of evidence that the defense counsel did know and determine whether a reasonable attorney would have followed up on that. Specifically in this case, just a couple of examples. You know, during the sentencing, Dwight Loving's stepfather was referred to as outspoken, and one of Dwight Loving's brothers described him as, quote, the worstest man, unquote, that he knew, but nobody else. What makes him the worst guy? He knows. And when you delve behind that, you know, you learn that he was an alcoholic that would be so intoxicated that he would urinate on the furniture. He berated and belittled the children daily, and forgive my language, but he basically said, you ain't shit, you're never going to be shit, every day of their lives. Counsel knew, for instance, on a different example. And testimony was presented that Dwight Loving's sister's house was burned down and that he had a brother beaten by gangs. Nobody asked, well, what happened to Dwight Loving? How is this relevant to him? When you ask that question, you find out that the sister's house was burned by a gang in an attempt to kill Dwight Loving or to get back at him because he had stood up against them to assist a friend. You learn that he was first beaten and robbed when he was 8 years old. And aside from that, they didn't even look at other people around the family members, other family members. For instance, Dwight Loving's aunt Eileen Anderson testified in the Dubay hearing. She lived in the Loving's home and lived nearby when Dwight Loving was a sibling, and she could testify. You know, what the sentencing panel heard from Brother Ronnie was that they basically had family fights with neighbors. When you delve beyond that, you find out for 18 months that these children were afraid to leave their house because when they did, the people next door were attacking them. Ms. Anderson was there personally and described the event when the family was playing cards, when Dwight Loving was no more than 5 years old, when every window in this house was shot up. She was down on the floor, her sister was down on the floor with children under their arms, describing the terror of that. And when you hear the terror from her of that, and you equate that to 5-year-old or 4-year-old Dwight Loving, you're hearing something real beyond family fights.
Now, did they not discuss with Armitage this issue of relating his background to his conduct?
Certainly, based on the information they had.
But you're saying that they should have gone, they didn't go into enough graphic detail because they did not know it.
Certainly. I'm not saying that Dr. Armitage did not fulfill his function. The focus is not on him at all. Dr. Armitage was limited to what the defense counsel brought before him in that tunnel vision. So all of this other stuff wasn't connected. And a social worker looks at different things, or a mitigation specialist looks at different things. Dr. Armitage was looking specifically on impact at the time of crime.
You're not suggesting that Dr. Armitage didn't conduct the appropriate testing and interviews with the appellant himself, are you?
No, ma'am. I'm not suggesting that at all. What Dr. Armitage was looking at was direct impact and nexus to the crime. That's not required for mitigation, and in fact, there are numerous cases. Wiggins itself, you know, talks about him being a victim of sexual abuse, being homeless, living in foster homes, being physically tormented, things that don't necessarily, you know, relate directly or can't be related directly. Mitigation is simply under the law, Skipper versus South Carolina.
But didn't Armitage have the capacity to say, well, this is interesting. Did you find out anything about the accused being beaten up, or did you find out anything about X or Y?
Your Honor, I don't think there was testimony that direct, but Dr. Armitage talked directly to Dwight Loving. That's pretty much what I can tell you on the basis of the evidence. But again, I can't answer. It's not evident.
Counsel, if you could, just at the end of the military judge, the person who did the debate hearings, responses to this court's questions, the final question was, do you think would the result have been any different? And the military judge said, even considering all the evidence that was presented at the debate hearing, your position is it should have been discovered and presented at the trial. I understand that. He did not think that the result would be any different. What is your response to how this court should view that finding?
Well, that's a legal finding. I mean, the essence of Strickland, whether there
was... But this is a debate hearing, and isn't that something that we asked him to do?
Certainly, that was part of the remand, but that's a de novo finding. But even if it's not, I submit that it's clear error. The standard is whether there's a reasonable probability that at least one panel member would have reached a different decision. That's not even a standard by preponderance of the evidence. We only have to show a reasonable probability.
And he said there is no reasonable probability that at least one member of the panel would have struck a different balance, thereby not voting for a death sentence.
That's certainly what the debate court found.
Counsel, I have a number of questions, and it may be better to ask them now rather than wait for a rebuttal so that the government will have an opportunity to address the same. With respect to the findings of fact, you've noted that with respect to the historical facts as to what counsel did or did not do, you did not have a disagreement with the DuBay judge's findings of fact. With respect to the sentencing evidence that was presented at the DuBay hearing, that is what people would have testified to, do you have any disagreement with the military judge's findings of fact as to which sentencing information would be considered and which should not be considered as to the information presented at the debate hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. Specifically, the military judge rejected the affidavits of siblings Harold Loving, Wendy Black, and Gwendolyn Black. Those affidavits given in 1992. Each of those witnesses confirmed that they had read their affidavits at the time, that they signed them, that when they signed them, it was true. But 17 years later, even if you're talking about people without issues, normal people, if you will, 17 years is a long time. Memories fade. When you add into what we know about this family's history, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, things change. I mean, Harold specifically testified that he has Parkinson's, it's a memory impairment. He didn't say anything inconsistent from his affidavit. He just said that he could not remember some of the details. For instance, he didn't remember specifics in 2008 that he put in his affidavit in 1992 about the fights, the mutual combat between his parents, but it was corroborated by other testimony. With respect to Gwen, she was certainly not a voluntary witness in this proceeding. She was escorted essentially to the hearing, put on the plane by the U.S. Marshals, but she testified. Her affidavit was true. She couldn't remember part of it. The only thing from her affidavit that she denied as true was that she, in fact, as a teenager, had been dealing drugs and enlisting White Loving's older brothers to work for her, but that evidence is out in other testimony. His mother is dead, of course, so there's no opportunity to present her. His brother Ronnie, who gave the most detailed information, and everybody in the family said that he was the older sibling with the most influence and time with White Loving, he was unavailable. You know, the government made its best attempt, but he evaded the U.S. Marshal. So by rejecting those affidavits, number one, it's not what the witnesses said. Their memory may not be as firm now, but they didn't deny anything other than specific things they corrected from their affidavits. And in essence, I submit that this court already found that based on these affidavits and records that were presented in the direct appeal, this court should have looked at the investigation and done a Dubay hearing. So in essence, White Loving is being penalized because of that 14-year delay.
Is our standard of review of those affidavits then clearly erroneous? That is, whether the military judge was clearly erroneous in his findings of fact at that point?
I believe that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Now, with respect to the standard that you've articulated, whether there's a reasonable possibility that at least one panel member would have struck a different balance on the issue of capital punishment. Assuming, and we have not decided, that ineffective assistance of counsel exists here, either with respect to the investigation or with respect to information that was not presented, and assuming that the judge erred with respect to those affidavits, what specific information was not presented to the sentencing panel that, contrasting it to the information that was presented to the sentencing panel, and how would that have raised the reasonable probability? In other words, what specifically, if we were to find, and we have not made any such finding, but if we were to find that counsel was ineffective either in the investigation or the presentation and that the judge erred in his findings of fact, what specific facts do you want us to look at in the question of whether there's a reasonable probability that one juror would have changed, one panel member would have changed?
There are a number of specifics, and in essence, if you take it, you know, just by caretakers with respect to his mother and sentencing, you know, in essence, she was portrayed as a woman that was doing her best with eight children, basically a single mother, and that she was living on welfare. But when you delve beyond that, you find out that she wanted to abort White Loving. He was the eighth of her children. From DSS records, which the trial attorneys didn't have, she was a harsh disciplinarian. She had a fiery temper, and she was absent. She was working nights. And aside from that, what was described in sentencing only as a medical condition, she had narcolepsy, which is basically a sleeping disease. Her daughter described that every hour or so, she would go to sleep in the middle of a sentence. Her sister described that she ultimately had to leave work because she worked in a mental hospital and was afraid of hurting a patient. With respect to the father, in sentencing, certainly he testified, and I'm sure from defense counsel's descriptions, could have been viewed by the panel member as not an upstanding guy, basically at that point homeless. But in sentencing, he said he spanked the children. In reality, from the descriptions and the testimony in the debate, he would strip the pants and the underwear off his sons and beat them with a belt until their skin burned. What Lucille described as having black eyes from him at times and a fear of death, in reality, was later mutual combat. Initially, she didn't fight back, but then she got to the point where she did fight back, and she would enlist her children to help her. Her oldest daughter, Wendy, during mutual combat, broke his kneecap. She stabbed her husband twice. She threw hot grease on him, all of this in front of children. The older sister, another caretaker. In sentencing, it was described that she helped her mother with the younger children. In reality, from the time she was 11, 12 years old, she was in charge of, taking care of, not just when mom was working, but during the period when mom could not function. She's taking care of seven younger children. She herself was a harsh disciplinarian by her own testimony. She used to knock them upside the head, and that's a quote. Her other sister, Gwen, who was next in line chronologically, was also involved in babysitting white clothing, and she testified herself that they made the boys fight, and if they didn't, they would hit them themselves. I've already described for you the difference in the evidence from the stepfather and the family fights, and the gang sentencing evidence versus the reality. And the reality on the gang violence from Ronnie, who of course is not available now, although he testified in 1989, was certainly cooperative in 1992, is that in addition to having windows shot out over his head as a child in the robbery, that at the ages of 12 to 13, the Dwight Loving was shot at three times. And if you add to that, if you step back to whether the defense counsel was engaged in deficient conduct and not getting a mitigation specialist, you have the expert testimony that described the developmental process and the psychological, emotional, and mental battering that basically explains who Dwight Loving is. You know, the concern of defense counsel in not presenting evidence to bring out antisocial personality disorder. Dwight Loving was that anyway to this panel. He was a man they didn't know, convicted of horrible crimes. They didn't learn anything about him. They heard general background. What this does is put the full man in front of them and allow them to make a judgment. It doesn't excuse his crimes. It explains them.
If there are no further questions, you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Captain Adam Kazin. I, along with Colonel Denise Lynn, represent the United States as respondent in this matter. The evidence and findings from the Boudet hearing confirm what this court already knew in 1994. The trial defense team's investigation and presentation of mitigating evidence was objectively reasonable. Petitioner has failed to meet his burden in establishing ineffective assistance of counsel and has failed to his burden of proving that this court's 1994 decision was objectively unreasonable. And it's very important that we discuss the standard of review because this is something unique to this court, something this court hasn't done very often, if ever at all, which is adopting the standards from 2254, the habeas review of state court decisions, to a decision of this court 14 years ago. And the standard is that this court is going to treat its decision in 1994 the way a federal habeas court treats state court decisions on federal habeas review. And that is a highly deferential standard under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Landrigan and several other decisions of the Supreme Court, which state that it is a higher burden to demonstrate something is unreasonable. And it is whether or not in 1994, when this court reviewed this very issue, whether or not it decided on an objectively unreasonable application of the law, that being Strickland versus Washington, or whether it based it on an objectively unreasonable application of the facts as known to the court at the time. That is the burden that petitioner must carry beyond the burden of carrying the burden, beyond the their burden to carry for ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, the trial defense team conducted an objectively reasonable investigation, and they employed a mitigation strategy throughout the process that was objectively reasonable, particularly in their decision to avoid the risk of revealing to the panel the petitioner's sociopath. That is an important point that dictates their mitigation strategy. The government, as well as the military judge at the debate hearing, as well as the Supreme Court of the United States, takes a broader view of what is the mitigation investigation than does petitioner.
Regardless of your view as to what was required then, what is the government's view today as to whether mitigation specialist is required for a death penalty case?
The government's position that it is not a per se requirement.
Today.
The standard is still when whether or not to employ a person is entitled to a any type of expert is the necessity standard that the Army Corps used in Kreutzer, which this court affirmed. Now, it may be fairly easy to demonstrate necessity, but there's a difference between a per se rule. And the Supreme Court of Strickland, when they first considered an ABA standard, and it wasn't the 89 ABA guidelines, it was the ABA's Code of Conduct on Criminal Justice, warned against this idea of per se rules. And as the ABA has...
You've answered my question. I don't want to get you sidetracked. I just want to know...
Counsel, I'd like to look at Wiggins for a minute. Wiggins said that the mitigation investigation steers the strategy rather than the other way around. And in this case, the military judge made a couple of findings that kind of raised flags for me. In one of his findings, he said, in this case, the defense team identified a mitigation theme, conducted a reasonable investigation to develop evidence that supported the validity of the theme. Now, it seems to me that what he's saying is that it's the other way around from what Wiggins dictated should occur.
And I think there's two parts to answer your question, Your Honor. First is, I think the military judge, it's the mitigation investigation and the mitigation strategy sort of feed off each other. He referred to it as an ongoing dynamic process, and certainly one is going to lead to the other. However, the second answer to your question is that Wiggins, the issue in Wiggins wasn't so much that there was an ineffective investigation as there was no investigation. Nothing happened. The attorneys in Wiggins really didn't leave their office in doing the investigation, so they couldn't come up with strategic decisions. Wiggins is a very unique set of factual circumstances. I think that the ongoing dynamic process of a mitigation investigation, when you initially interview your client, as they did in this case, they saw patterns. They saw patterns of his obsessiveness with Nadia. And they made decisions. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that their entire mitigation strategy was made. They testified that they were looking at other things. They were looking at mental health aspects. And they made initially three decisions when they first interviewed Dwight Loving back in 1988. The first was they wanted to hire a forensic psychiatrist because they could identify very early there were mental health issues. The second is that they noted his obsessiveness with Nadia, which was confirmed again and again through various witnesses. And the third thing they wanted to do was they wanted to go to his hometown. So right there, they're making decisions that show a broader look at a mitigation case. And that's what they were looking at from the very beginning. They never really thought they had a case on findings, although they did make an attempt to convince the panel that premeditation wasn't there. But from the moment they walked into that courtroom, they knew that they were going to be in a sentencing case.
Counsel, do you know at what point in the process the Sanity Board report was made available to the defense counsel?
I don't have an exact date. I believe it was mid-February. It was right around when Major Hayden was in Rochester. It was right around that time period.
And do you have an opinion or a view as to how much of the information that appellant's counsel or that Loving's counsel is talking about today that should have been discovered by the defense counsel was contained in that report?
Well, the closed portion of the Senate Board report did contain a great deal of information, most of it from Private Loving himself. And they did rely on that information as much as you should rely on a sanity board report, where it's got a very unfavorable diagnosis of your client. They didn't rely exclusively on that, though.
I understand.
And one of the things that they did do, is kind of dovetails into my next point, is that they use different people for different jobs. The mitigation investigation was not just the time in Rochester. That is a very narrow view of what the mitigation investigation is. The mitigation investigation was everything they did in preparation for that trial up until the day of trial. And that included going to his home in Rochester, and they didn't just speak to family members. They spoke to people in the community, local police officers.
Did they go to both homes in Rochester?
I believe they just went to I don't know if they went to this one on Oakman Street, Your Honor, but they did know about the Oakman Street versus the Stunt Street.
So the record does not reflect that they went to the Oakman Street address?
Off the top of my head, I cannot say, Your Honor. It may
well. Is that a thorough investigation to not go to one of the two homes?
Well, they went to the home at the time. I'm not sure if that makes
sense. Did they go to the home where most of the violent activity had occurred?
Major Hayden did testify that he did go into that area and that he didn't.
Which home was viewed as the worst neighborhood?
The Oakman Street was the worst neighborhood, Your Honor.
And the record does not reflect that they went there?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I can't say off the top of my head. It might be it's a very large joint appendix. I don't know for sure.
Would it have been prudent to go to the home without conceding whether it had been effective or ineffective to go to the home?
Well, I'm not sure if it would have been prudent or not, Your Honor, but that actually leads me to a point that it's not, as the court in Berger stated, it's not what is prudent, but what is constitutionally required.
No, I was just asking.
Yes, Your Honor. I also don't know, Your Honor. To second guess the trial defense team 20 years later would be exactly what Strickland told us not to do, is to look through hindsight and say a different lawyer might have done something different. And perfection is not the standard. I know that's hard to say in a capital case because we really want perfection in a capital case.
What about the decision to, I'm not sure which words were used, but there was apparently a tactical decision to rush to trial. Their words were to speed things along to get a jump on the government. Is that, and that's just intended to be a paraphrase, not a effort to quote.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe what
why is that a sound tactical choice?
They filed a 707 motion, Your Honor, trying to argue that the government did not bring it within 120 days. And they did decide.
And in the debate testimony, they say that they consciously chose to rush things along.
Well, or
words to that effect.
They certainly did not think that extending the case out indefinitely, as many capital cases today often do, was in their client's best interest. The government, getting a jump on the government might be a way of approaching it. Different attorneys might have a different approach.
Asking you, though, why would that be a sound tactical choice? Here you have a case where you have a dramatic videotape confession, and they recognize from the get-go that, correctly or incorrectly, that the sentencing stage is going to be the pivotal area for them. Why are they advantaged by rushing to get to that portion of the event?
And Your Honor, I'm not sure that they were rushing. They felt they were ready. They felt they had everything they needed. They had the expert that they wanted.
That's not what they said in the debate hearing. They may have felt they were ready, but they did say they had a conscious choice to rush.
Well, and the word rush, Your Honor, implies that it wasn't careless. It wasn't a pressure decision. It was a decision they made, and they consulted with the petitioner in making that decision. That was also part of the testimony, that they talked to him about it, and they discussed their strategy with their client, and they moved forward.
Does the record reflect whether there was information about Private Loving that was available to the defense that was negative with respect to Private Loving, that because of the speed with which trial took place was not... that the government was not aware of it? So, for instance, and I'm not sure where I saw it in opinion, the fact that he had sexually molested his 10-year-old niece when he was 16, was that information at the disposal of the government at the time of trial?
There's no evidence that the government had any idea of that, Your Honor. It may have been in the CID report, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but it certainly wouldn't have been able something the government could have presented. And it was mainly, I believe, that's found in the Sanity Board report, which is the closed portion of the Sanity Board report, which the government did not have at that time. Now, the investigation report, there may have been some mention of it. I simply can't speak verbatim from what the CID report said. But the mitigation investigation did what a mitigation investigation is supposed to do, which is get tangible evidence and witnesses for trial. And that's exactly what they did. Mother, brothers, sisters, father, boxing coach, high school teacher. This is all the information, all the witnesses that were presented at trial. That is a reasonable investigation. They, and the information that they brought out had the information regarding Joe Loving Sr., his abuse of Lucille. He was drunk and jealous. There were times that Lucille thought that he was going to kill her. There were times that the children had to step in on the fights. All this information is in there. The dangerousness of Rochester was a big part of the mitigation case. Lucille Loving testified about it. Carol Loving testified about it. Ronald Loving testified about it. Investigator Jimmy Verner's entire testimony from the joint appendix from 285 to 98 is pretty much about how bad Rochester is. Lord Johnson testified about the gang problems. The Lucille worked nights and had narcolepsy is right there in the sentencing case. That she disciplined her children with a belt or hand is right there in the sentencing case. And the main thing, one thing that led to their overall strategy was that Private Loving was easily led and easily manipulated, particularly by women. Now, the judge addressed this idea of you can either do a shotgun approach where you basically throw everything and anything at the panel and hope they figure it out for themselves, or you can have a focused strategy, which doesn't exclude information, but certainly has a theme that a panel member, only one panel member, need choose that this person does not need the death penalty. And that was that Dwight Loving was manipulated and was under the sway of Nadia. That was a big theme. And the evidence that they used supported that theme, while at the same time giving the panel an idea of where Private Loving came from and what his life was like. And that is what attorneys are supposed to do, not only in a death penalty case, but hopefully in every court-martial that soldiers are trying. Petitioner's argument, and this was in the petition, and this was also throughout the Dubé hearing, is that there was no linkage evidence, that this is what they're really looking for. This is the linkage evidence that could explain to a panel, spoon-feed the panel, if you will, this information, explain to them why it's significant. And the witness of choice, or the expert of choice for a petitioner now, is a social worker, in this case, Ms. Vogelsang. The problem with someone like Ms. Vogelsang is that she is not a lay witness, as petitioner tried to allege in the original petition to this court back in 2006. She is an expert in social work, and a social worker is a mental health care expert. That is the type of witness that they claim they needed in order to make linkage evidence. Right, that is where the real fault lies. And the problem with this is that they did have a mental health care expert, but they recognized that the problem with putting on a mental health care expert, whether it be a forensic psychiatrist or a clinical social worker, is that you reveal to the panel and you reveal to the government the details of that petitioner's associate have. That is a bad thing to tell a panel when you're trying to save someone's life. When the defense is trying to argue that their client is feeling remorse, when the defense is trying to argue that their client is not a future danger to society, that is not a word you want before the panel. So they knew that they could not present a mental health care expert. What petitioner does now is they say, well, we want to replace the mental health care expert that you had then with our choice of mental health care expert. And petitioner, in his most recent brief, argues that they should have just gone ahead and risked it. They should have said, hey, they already know essentially he's a sociopath, even though that word was never once mentioned.
Well, in fairness to counsel, was it the word sociopath that was the issue, or was it the prospect of having the Dr. Armitage or somebody up there getting cross-examined on what that meant and so on?
Well, certainly that's part of the risk, Your Honor, because if the government
did
gets...
Did they consciously go through that risk, so that was not just something they defaulted past?
That's exactly... Your Honor, Dr. Armitage has testified this at the Dubé hearing, that they had a very specific discussion about this, that if he were to testify, he said, I can testify about his life history. I've talked to his parents, I've talked to his mom, his dad, I've talked to his brothers and sisters. I talked to him for almost two solid days, getting all this information and getting an idea. I've looked at the Sanity Board report. I've looked at all the information that was presented. And I can testify about how his traumatic life, if that's the words one wants to use, his traumatic life impacted him at the time of the crimes. I can make that linkage that petitioner is now arguing for. The problem there is that no mental health care worker, no mental health care expert can ignore the diagnosis that petitioner had at that time, which is antisocial personality disorder. And antisocial personality disorder, right out of the DSM, is a sociopath. On top of that, you have the closed portions of the Sanity Board, which would then come into play in some manner on these, which talks about that he has a preoccupation with self-indulgent pleasure-seeking, with little thought for the rights and feelings of others. That is not something you want to risk having the panel make here. or even having the government being able to play with that type of information and maybe having their own expert up there. And the courts have fairly universally held that, you know, this type of mental health care testimony is a double-edged sword. You can spin it one way and perhaps use it as mitigation evidence, but then it can be spun right back at you with information that your client is dangerous, your client does not have any rehabilitative potential. And I point this court's attention to the 10th Circuit cases in Mullen and Gibson, the 7th Circuit case in Cowan, both Peer versus Cowan and Ritz versus Cowan, where it talks about how antisocial personality disorder makes people less likely for lenity than more likely for lenity. And this type of information, whether or not to proceed with it, or whether or not to present it, or how to use it, is exactly the type of tactical decisions we have to leave to attorneys, because they have an understanding of how it's going to play out in the court before them.
What there's back and forth in the briefs over whether McGlasson indicated that they should, could, might, whatever, get a social worker or mitigation specialist. Let me start over again. And the government takes the view that he did not indicate that it was required. And now my question is not did McGlasson say it was required or not. Let's say he merely said it was a good idea.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or some people do it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't it reasonable in the context of a death penalty case to, if anybody tells you to do anything, that you do it and make the government, the judge say no? Well, why not?
Some people
stand outside and look up. Okay, let's try it.
And I would say, Your Honor, that certainly good ideas are always welcome. And Mr. McGlasson had some ideas. The problem with Mr. McGlasson and with the Life in the Balance project and the people there was...
My real question is one about just practicing law, which is if anybody gives you any idea, why self-select it out rather than make the judge tell you you can't have it?
Well, and I guess, Your Honor, the answer to that is that would require us to take every idea and would basically substitute counsel's judgment and counsel's decision-making process and create this kind of per se process. Someone gives you a good idea, go ahead and run with it.
All right, now we're going to, it's my own fault I asked too abstract the question.
Yes, Your Honor.
What would be the tactical reason not to go back and ask for a mitigation specialist?
And Major Hayden testified about this. They discussed the idea and they decided they didn't need one. And they decided that Major Hayden specifically testified during his debate that if they thought they needed one, they would have asked for one. They had conducted a mitigation investigation. They had the type of mental health care expert that they wanted.
Let's say you're right on the law and this is an emerging concept. Okay? You win on that. It's emerging. Well, then they don't really know much about it. Shouldn't they go get one to see what happens with it?
I don't think, rather, that it requires the defense counsel to experiment. The law certainly doesn't require the defense counsel to experiment. They had three attorneys on here. They were happy with their defense team. They had gotten witnesses. They had done a mitigation investigation. It took them a while to get the investigator, the right forensic psychiatrist, and they didn't just take the first one that the government offered them. They did all this work, and they were ready to go forward. And they were confident that they could find one person to find that the death penalty was not appropriate. That was their goal. That was their strategy. With respect to Mr. McGlasson, there was other issues with him and his advice. One of them is he had no concept of court-martials or concept of the military. And this came into play on a couple of occasions. Mr. Ibbotson described it as sometimes trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. An example of this is that the Life in the Balance...
You've answered my question. You're on your dime now.
To a point that one of the pieces of advice they would give is make sure there are no military people on your juries. And when Mr. Ibbotson raised his hand and said, well, this is a court-martial, everyone's military, they sort of looked at him like he had horns growing out of his head. And so it wasn't necessarily that they had a good understanding of what he was trying to accomplish in a court-martial or an understanding of military panels, because any attorney knows that, you know, the personality of your panel is going to vary from where you are. A jury in Texas is not going to be the same as a jury in Maine. And Mr. Ibbotson talked about throughout it how he had an understanding of what information would be best presented to a court-martial panel. The other thing with the Life in the Balance information was that Even in the materials that are provided to this court from petitioner, there's no mention of you have to have a social worker, you have to have a mitigation specialist. And I would like to actually address a question Judge Baker had for petitioner about the ABA guideline that talks about, you know, expert testimony. And I believe the one you're looking for is ABA guideline 11.8.3.F.2. Those are all subparagraphs. And this is at the joint appendix at 1779 to 1780. And the ABA guideline talks about in deciding which witnesses and evidence to prepare for presentation at the sentencing phase, counsel should consider expert witnesses to provide medical, psychological, sociological, or other explanations for the offenses for which the client is being sentenced. I believe that's the one that everyone is referencing. And I would point the court's attention to the word consider. Let's think about it. It does not mean you have to do this. It is not a mandate. These are not commandments sent down from heaven and chiseled into stone. They are guidelines. By the ABA's admission, and I use admission because it's in the guidelines, they say that there were no standards for practice or no national guidelines prior to those guidelines. And they specifically removed the word standard and replaced it with guideline. And in all the decisions that petitioner talks about, Rompia, Wiggins, that's one word they don't use. They don't use the term standard. They use norm, they use guideline. They never say it's a standard. If we say something is a standard, minimum per se standard, you've essentially taken away an attorney's ability to consider it. Now, this case, petitioner mentioned Rompia, and I would like to point the court's attention, this is nothing like Rompia. In Rompia, there was a very specific finding in that case that the defense attorneys, despite the prosecution telling them that they're going to make his prior convictions a big part of their case, never looked at the post-conviction, the prior conviction file. So that was the common sense, and they said there was other information that could have been gleaned from there. This case is also nothing like Wiggins versus Smith. A petitioner makes in their brief, in their petition, in their argument before the debate court, that this case is somehow just like Wiggins. And I've already discussed a little bit how this case is nothing like Wiggins. And I encourage the court to look at both the district court opinion in Wiggins and the intermediate appellate court decision, which really talks about how little or nothing those attorneys did. They relied completely on reports handed to them by the government. They conducted no independent investigation. They also had an investigator on staff and didn't use them. Also, the interesting in Wiggins is that the attorneys couldn't even decide who was in charge of the mitigation case. At the district court below, they both sort of pointed the fingers at each other and said, he's in charge. As opposed to our case where the attorneys agreed that Major Hayden was certainly the lead on it, but that they shared responsibility for it. No one was trying to shirk responsibility for the mitigation case, as was the case in Wiggins. I would point this court's attention to the case, the recent case out of the Fourth Circuit, Wilson versus Osmond. It was a decision which is the procedural arguments, or at least the legal arguments, are strikingly similar to the ones we have here today. They made the exact same claims in Wilson that they did not use a mitigation specialist, they did not use a social worker, and that was somehow required. And the Wilson court pretty much rejected that argument on the ground, same grounds that the government is arguing today. Wilson alleged that the failure of his counsel in this regard bears a striking resemblance to Wiggins versus Smith. What the court Wilson said was that that resemblance was superficial at best. And any comparisons in this case to Wiggins are equally superficial. In this case, the trial defense attorneys did a reasonable investigation. They presented the case to the panel, and 20 years of second guessing should not overrule that. This brings me back to the standard of review. Whether or not this court on a direct review might have found ineffective assistance of counsel is not the question. And I would point the court's attention to two cases, one out of the Fifth Circuit, one out of the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit case is Ringo versus Roper, cited in the government's brief. It was a 2007 case. The Fifth Circuit case being St. Aubin versus Quarterman. It's a 2006 case out of the Fifth Circuit. Both those courts addressed, particularly the Ringo court, that they might have found ineffective assistance of counsel if they were looking at that. The Ringo court particularly said that there might be a good argument counsel's conduct in that case was deficient. But they said that under the APA standards, it's not whether or not a good argument can be made for it. It is whether or not petitioner demonstrates that this court's review of this very issue in 1994 was objectively unreasonable. And it is extremely difficult to demonstrate that someone is objectively unreasonable. And petitioner needs to be held to his standard.
Counsel, in that light, on page 145 of of our decision at 64MJ. That standard is set forth as a standard that we would apply. Assuming that we adhere to that standard here, it would appear that there are two, but perhaps let me know more, ways in which the government would prevail. One is to show that there was not the unreasonable application of law that, in effect, that counsel conducted a reasonable investigation applying that standard. Or two, the second part is resulted in a decision that was based on unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence. And that would, in that, one would look, in effect, at the second prong of Strickland, and either, if we were to find that the counsel was ineffective applying the AEDPA standard, or simply pass over the ineffectiveness, find that under the facts of this case, it was not an unreasonable determination of the facts. In that light, that is, if we were to focus on, is there any other way the government would prevail than other than under those two standards?
I think those accurately sum up, Your Honor. I think the court could also just say that the petitioner never met his burden in this instance of even making the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, okay. Which would then tie in. The standards sort of tie into each other. Because
that ties into really the first standard.
Yes, Your Honor, they tie into the first standard because all of the burdens are on petitioner at this stage, and if petitioner fails to meet any one of these burdens, then he is not entitled to writ.
Now, focusing on the second standard, same question I asked the petitioner with respect to the findings of fact by the military judge as to the sentencing evidence that he, in effect, excluded, that is, those affidavits. What would be the government's position, number one, as to whether the judge was clearly erroneous, if that's the standard that would be applied in his making that determination at trial? And at the Dubé hearing, and secondly, assuming that that evidence would be considered, whether it would have any particular impact on the our determination here.
And Your Honor, there are three really parts to our answers to your question. The first is that the standard is clearly erroneous. The military judge's findings of fact, anything that is considered a finding of fact, is reviewed for clear error. The second part of the answer to the question is, the military judge didn't exclude the affidavits. Everything was taken in. It was admitted into evidence. He considered it. He simply made credibility determinations about it.
Well, didn't he, in effect, in making that credibility determination, say that that information would not have been considered by any reasonable juror, and therefore he took it off the table for purposes of our review of this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that he was.
Okay, so in the government's view, that we can consider that evidence as favorable to the petitioner if we choose to?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I said it wasn't excluded from evidence, so it's in the record. And I just want to
By making a determination that it was not credible, is he not saying that that is information that, unless we find him to be clearly erroneous, we cannot consider for purposes of determining the sentencing evidence that might have persuaded one reasonable juror?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
My next part was assuming the credibility determination.
Right. So in that sense, what's your view as to whether his, as to was the basis for his determination that that information would not have been considered by at least one reasonable juror, that is, it was not credible?
I think, in many ways, a finding of fact, but it is also, there's factual findings within it, but there is a conclusion of law at the end. But this court specifically asked the judge to make that finding, and I think the court owes the judge the deference because he's heard the witnesses, he saw them, he saw how they testified, and that is an important factual component to it. And the military judge made the finding that there was no reasonable probability that had this additional information come in, and everything along with it, all good, the bad.
I'm just focusing on that finding. That is, what is the basis for finding that those affidavits could not be considered by at least one reasonable juror? The information in the affidavits. The judge focused on staleness and the inability to remember many years later. What is the government's view as to the basis for that credibility determination?
Well, another part of it, I think a big part of that basis, Your Honor, was how the affidavits were obtained. The military judge inquired specifically, who wrote these affidavits? Where did these affidavits come from? And no one could answer the question. No one had an answer for where these affidavits came from, where they come from a CID agent, that they come from a social worker doing an investigation. So that certainly added to the credibility of the problem of the affidavits. Particularly, the witnesses also said they often breezed through the affidavit before signing it. So there's a reliability problem with those affidavits that the judge noted. But I think that even the information within those affidavits is, at best, cumulative with information that was already presented at the debate here, which is why it goes to that finding of it would not have had an impact on the jury's findings, the panel's findings.
Okay. And my next question, again, the same question that I asked the petitioner. Your brief focuses primarily on the question of whether there was or was not a reasonable investigation and all the standards related related to that. What you have not focused on, and it's a choice on your part, is the question that we asked the debate judge. The number one question was what facts were either omitted or not completely stated, and then in the last question he asked to tie that into whether that would have an impact on the on at least one juror. And is there anything that you would like to add to what you've said at this point on that particular point?
Yes, Your Honor, and the government did in its brief to the debate judge address that that issue, and I would encourage the court to, it's in the record of the debate record to review the government's argument there, but in summing that argument up is that there was nothing that was inadvertently omitted or inadvertently missed or accidentally not read. They did an investigation, but the scour the earth proposition of getting every single piece of information is not the standard. And that goes back to perfection not being the standard. And the Supreme Court talked about this in Berger. Several circuit courts have talked about it that are citing the government's brief is a defense counsel can always do more or find more. I mean, it can always happen. If that were the standard, then no one would have done enough. And therefore, if there was a particular anecdotal story they didn't have, it wasn't ineffective. It wasn't for lack of investigation. They simply don't know every single piece of information about their client's life. That's not the standard. It's a reasonable investigation. And to say that you must know everything about a person's life would essentially say that if you don't know one little thing about their life, you haven't conducted a reasonable investigation. So certainly there were anecdotal stories that were not told with the same dramatic flair as were perhaps presented in particular brief or an argument today, but that does not mean that it was missed. And I would highly encourage the court to look at the sentencing case from front to back of the original trial, and you'll see that the information, if not the same form and fashion, was in there. The information about abuse, the information about the Rochester, the information about the narcolepsy and all these items. And it was actually specifically instructed to the panel about considering the poor life that he had in Rochester and his alcoholic father, and all these things were considered. They were part of a broader mitigation case, as opposed to trying to make the mitigation case just about the life history.
Counsel, through the questions of the court, the defense had more than the allotted 30 minutes, and so I'd like to provide you with the opportunity if there's anything further. We do have your brief and we have your argument, but if there's a point that you wish to make an oral argument, you may do so now.
If I just may have a moment, Your Honor, because I had quite a few notes. Your Honor, pending the court, any further questions from the court, I think I've addressed everything I needed to address today.
Thank you,
briefly conclude.
Yes, you may.
This court's decision in 1994 was objectively reasonable, both in its determination of facts and its application of law, the ultimate question for this court to determine now. The trial defense team conducted a thorough, professional defense in petitioner's case. Their investigation and presentation and mitigation of evidence was, in fact, reasonable. Petitioner received a death sentence not from non-existent defense omissions, but for the crimes he committed. Petitioner has failed to meet a single legal burden that would entitle him to a writ of habeas corpus, and this court need not delay any further in denying the petition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does counsel for petitioner have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, in response to Judge Baker's question, the guideline I was actually referring to is not what government counsel refers to. Specifically, I was looking at guideline 11.4.1.D7, where it refers to experts assisting in investigation and other preparation of the defense. I was also referring to the commentary guideline and 8.1, which refers to expert witnesses capable of testifying at trial and at other proceedings, personnel skilled in social work and related disciplines to provide assistance at sentencing, and trained investigators to interview witnesses and to assemble demonstrative evidence. I would also cite to Wiggins versus Smith itself, which made the point as one finding that forensic social workers were standard in Maryland in 1989, and I would submit the standard for the military certainly would not be any less than in any civilian jurisdiction.
Now, in the guidelines with 7D, the chapeau says counsel should secure the assistance of experts where it is necessary or appropriate for preparation of the defense, blah, 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 presentation and mitigation. So you're not, do you read that as saying there's a requirement or that there's a requirement where it's necessary or appropriate?
I don't think there's an absolutely requirement, but again, the standard, the ABA guidelines set forth what Wiggins refers to as the well-defined norm. It's a standard of care. It's a standard of practice to say that if you don't do this, it's impossible for you to be ineffective, but certainly it is the standard of care, and certainly in this case, it was an element of their deficient conduct. Judge Ryan asked a question about whether the government was aware of the sexual abuse allegation. They were, in fact, aware of that. It's in the joint appendix at page 1740, and that is a government exhibit from a debate hearing that is, in fact, the CID report. So they were aware of that even before Dwight Loving's defense counsel went there, specifically referring to allegations that he had sexually abused or raped his niece. Government counsel also relies heavily on this avoiding the antisocial personality disorder strategy. Without the full investigation, an informed decision was impossible. They could not possibly choose not to present what they didn't know.
And well, counsel, you don't disagree that something that they did know was that their own forensic psychiatrist would have testified, if he had testified, that it would not have been beneficial testimony for appellant with respect to rehabilitative potential, for example.
They did. They knew that on the eve of trial. Dr. Armitage did not evaluate or examine Dwight Loving until just before panel selection started. So that had no impact.
Well, this information was contained in the mental responsibility board, wasn't it?
Yes, but they did not know from their own expert, and the decision was not made according to their testimony and Dr. Armitage's testimony that he would not testify until the eve of trial. So that could not have any impact on their mitigation strategies before that, and ultimately what strategies you have don't impact the investigation you conduct. It's the reverse order. The investigation you conduct, as the Supreme Court in Wiggins, quoting the 1989 guidelines, the investigation should comprise efforts to discover all reasonably available mitigating evidence. Once you know that evidence, you can make a choice. You can choose your strategies. That's the problem in Wiggins. They didn't know the evidence. That's the problem in this case.
Counsel,
ultimately what they present doesn't impact.
Counsel, Judge Urban's trying to ask you a question.
I'm sorry.
You had earlier, or just recently, said that Wiggins versus Smith held that use of a forensic social worker was the prevailing norm, and that if it was in Maryland, it certainly should be in the military system. Didn't the Supreme Court there say that it was the prevailing norm in Maryland, and didn't in Maryland the legislature set aside funding for forensic social workers? And is that a different case than we have in the military?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if it was the Maryland legislature or the public defender office.
Well, there was dedicated itself, funding for that.
There certainly was funding available, and it was standard practice in capital cases.
In Maryland?
In Maryland.
Okay. Did the court indicate that was a national norm?
No, Your Honor. Okay. That was one finding of deficiency, along with not complying with the well-defined norms of the ABA guidelines. Ultimately, they did not have a strategy not to get a mitigation specialist. They did not have a strategy not to present background evidence. They testified. They would have, regardless of expert, they testified. They didn't present additional evidence because it wasn't available to them. And ultimately, Judge Baker asked about going to the house. Wouldn't that be an obvious thing? Certainly, as the Supreme Court, again, relying on the guidelines.
Does the record reflect that they did not go to the house?
Major Hayden testified, I believe, that he went to the neighborhood. I may be wrong about that, but regardless, assuming he went to the house. He didn't ask about all the details of what happened in that house. He was looking for specific information that he detailed and I listed previously. And that is contrary to an investigation for all reasonably available mitigation evidence. They simply didn't do it. As I quoted in a brief from numerous cases, the ultimate responsibility of a lawyer in a capital case is to walk a mile in his client's shoes, get to know him, and present that evidence to explain to the jury this isn't just a murderer before you. He wasn't born with a gun in his hand. This is how he got here. His older sister's making him fight, his older brother giving him drugs, gangs, all of that information. Whether you look at it as whether they would have ultimately decided to present an expert or not, they could not possibly make a reasonable strategic decision. And in fact, they did. They didn't have all the information.
Counsel, your time's expired. If you'd like to make a concluding statement, you may.
Your Honor, I will rest with that.
Thank you, Counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30 a.m.
All rise.